evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ben Saul from the Faculty of Law, the University of New South Wales. Thank you all for coming this evening. I'm delighted to welcome to Australia Professor Connor Gearty, the Director of the Centre for Human Rights at the London School of Economics, and one of Britain's leading human rights academics and barristers. Connor, more importantly, was my PhD examiner, and in return for passing my PhD, I invited him on a little trip to Australia. Professor Hilary Charlesworth is, as you know, from the Australian National University. Professor Charlesworth is one of Australia and indeed the world's most distinguished international lawyers. This year she was awarded the Butcher Medal by the American Society for International Law for her in recognition of her work in international human rights law. She was also chair of the ACT's Human Rights Act Consultative Committee, which recommended a Human Rights Act for the ACT, and which was ultimately enacted in 2004. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome Hilary up from Canberra, not so far this evening. Now, the format this evening is, first up, I'd like to invite both speakers to stand up at the lectern and give a five-minute overview of their approach to human rights and civil liberties issues in an age of terrorism. First up, I'd like to call on Professor Gearty to make his opening statement. Please welcome both speakers.
Very much, Ben. I do remember the start of that oral exam for a PhD. It went something like this, Mr., emphasizing the Mr., so have you been thinking about inviting me to Australia at all? And then I think Ben is pretty quick on the uptake. He took the hint, and the oral examination went swimmingly thereafter. Actually, as you'll see, I don't want to waste any of my 5 minutes more of this abuse, but as you'll see, he has set this up as a way of getting revenge on me, because he's produced a variety of questions which are completely unanswerable. And I suggested we should take questions from the audience. He said, oh no, he says, this is me cross-examining you, so I need audience support later on. Well, I'm delighted, of course. I mean, of course, that's saying to be here in Sydney. My first visit to Australia, first of all, I won't give up for revenge. I thought I'd use my 4 minutes now, 4.5 minutes. I've wasted 30 seconds on humorous humour. Attempt at humour, I should say, rather than humour. Not be optimistic about my ability. Just why I'm involved in, and why I'm involved in this subject of terrorism. So there'll be opportunities in the course of the next 50 minutes or so to expand a bit on theory and so on. Some of you might have guessed this, from Ireland originally. I've been 20 years in England and still sound just like my brother in Midlands of Ireland, which is great. But I got into the subject because I came over to England in 1981 and there was a lot of terrorism. And you may remember the Osama bin Laden of the day was Gerry Adams and also Bobby Sands. And then we had things like the attack on the British authorities in Brighton, the Grand Hotel being blown up. We had the mortar assault on the British cabinet of John Major. So I do find it slightly odd that Mr. Blair thinks that we have unprecedented threats to the British government. The British government has been blown up twice. I remember the little van that parked, the IRA van that parked in the mall, right in front of the soldiers who stand up, who sit on the horses. And they parked the van, they got the little mortar ready, and they wound it up. And the classic example of the British approach to the military, the guys wouldn't get off the horses because they're told to look good for the tourists, and so the bombs landed down the street. But I became very involved in the idea of terrorism. And then I decided I'd like to write a book about terrorism, and terrorism law. I'm a lawyer. And I discovered it was impossible to do so, frankly. Because the subject I discovered, I thought, I came to an understanding of, was not a legal subject. And this revelation came to me in a discussion with this guy from the RAND Corporation, top guy, Brian Jenkins. He had advised governments in the United States of America since Kennedy on terrorism. He had been one of the originators and managers of the Phoenix program in Vietnam. Some of you will be aware of what that was, a highly controversial program, to put it extremely mildly. involving assassination. But he knew the business from the front end. And he was talking about terrorism. He ran the RAND department on terrorism, advised presidents and so on. And he talked about the terrible challenge of terrorism and so on. But I asked him a question. The then anxiety was being generated by Hezbollah in Lebanon and by Gaddafi. Gaddafi is on the verge of winning a Nobel Prize, as you know, but he was briefly Osama bin Laden, taking over from Abu Nidal, who's now a forgotten Osama bin Laden. These guys come and go, you know, all the time. I said to Brian Jenkins, I said, so Hezbollah attacking the American Marines in Beirut is terrorism, yes. But if Iran launched an aerial bombardment using Iranian airplanes, or if the Iranian Air Force and military wearing Iranian military uniform attacked the embassy, it would not be terrorism. No. What would happen to them? They'd all be killed. Yes, they would. So if the Iranians, and it goes for all of these guys, had chosen a kind of violence that avoids the label terrorist, they would get beaten. So that we are requiring them to behave in a way which guarantees their destruction. And then I asked him, if the Israelis had used a proxy group to kill PLO operatives in Tunis, that would be international terrorism. Yes. But because the Israelis do it themselves, it's counter-terrorism. So as long as I said, there's something wrong with this subject. There's something peculiar about it. And so I wrote, and have been writing ever since, about the subject of terrorism in its political context. And in summary, I believe that terrorism is a method of political violence. It's not a category of violent person. I believe that it's a method of violence that can be deployed by states, by guerrilla forces, by elements in a civil war, and by the weakest political killers of all, the violent subversives who lack the strength to have a guerrilla force behind them, and who lack the strength to have an army behind them, and who are reduced to sporadic attacks of a spectacular nature. Yes, they are also terrorists, but they are doing terror, something which can be done more efficiently and more effectively by the armed forces of states. So that puts me a little bit at the extreme end of the terrorism discussion and debate. Human rights is a later thing. I'll finish then. I'm sure I'm running up to my 5 minutes. Human rights is my main academic interest. And what has happened in the course of the last 5 years or so has been a really scary challenge to the principles that underpin human rights from people who say, like Mr. Blair, the British Prime Minister, the rules have changed, and that we somehow or other have to now revise our thinking of human rights because of the threat of terrorism. But this, and it's my final point before I sit down just at this preliminary stage, this is being supported by so-called human rights experts. This is not something that the entire human rights community is affronted by. The human rights people are split, and this is an extremely dangerous development. The majority of human rights people say you shouldn't intern, you shouldn't torture, you shouldn't engage in a parody of justice in the name of counterterrorism. But some say that human rights are about our values as a Western culture, and that we are threatened, they say, by this other civilization, by this horrific evil, is the word they often use. And because we're so threatened, we must ourselves engage in some necessary evil. That's the actual title of a book published by a professor of human rights. And our necessary evil is less evil than theirs, because when we beat people up, we have certain rules. And when we engage in solitary confinement of people, we do so under instructions and with a doctor around the corner. Now, this is a highly dangerous development. And it's the one which I am seeking, you know, in some of my work, and a lot of people more engaged than me are seeking to prevent. Because we have a nightmare possibility, which is that we have a society with no respect for human dignity, which is actually a society that has persuaded itself that it's a human rights respecting society. And we mustn't let people get away with that delusion. So I think I'll stop there, and I think I'll hand over to Hilary or Ben. Thank you. Thank you.
you can see why I was terrified in my oral exam of Carnegie's question. Hilary Charlesworth, over to you.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks to Ben, the Gilbert and Tobin Centre, for having me here. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of this land. I was just thinking, somebody was telling Connor and I before that they came expecting some blood on the floor, a great debate between the two of us, but I think certainly from what I read of Connor and what he just said, that we probably are going to dully agree on many of these topics. But I actually come to these issues from quite a different perspective to Connor, but I suspect that we probably meet somewhere in the middle. So I am not an expert at all on terrorism as such. Indeed, I've started my career as an international human rights lawyer, so my interest has always been primarily in international human rights law and the way that it actually works in national legal systems. But I've encountered, obviously, the issue of terrorism over the last, I guess, 4 or 5 years, especially obviously since the 11th September 2001, because it's been, I think, the major threat in devaluing the notion of human rights. So I just want to use this time just to talk about, I guess, three major concerns I have with some of the vocabulary that we find ourselves sort of accepting and not questioning in any way at all. So the term, the war on terror, or an age of terror, indeed, you know, the very title of our discussion tonight, has become something that we just accept. And so this language, particularly, Ben has been on what is the age of terrorism, but war on terrorism is something that sort of comes to one's lips very naturally. I think this is really the result this use, especially by politicians in the public realm, has really resulted in what Amitav Acharya, the Singaporean academic, has called an age of total fear, in which concepts of national security are really used to trump all other ideas about freedom and human security. Now, one real problem with the image of war, I think, when we're dealing with the phenomenon of terrorism, is that it implies, first of all, that it's possible to run some sort of discrete campaign against terrorism, that there's an enemy that's identified or that's out there and able to be conquered. So the use of this notion of war implies that the violence is somehow finite. So there will be an end to the war. It won't be this year, but it will be in the foreseeable future. But of course, there's also another image of terrorism that our politician has now recognised, and in a sense, we'll never be able to claim a victory in the war. In that sense, the war on terror also looms as absolutely infinite. So there's this really complex mixture of both the infinity and the finiteness of this war. So it seems to me the war terminology is just not useful at all in responding to really systemic complex problems, and I think it distorts expectations about the outcome of the war, and it can also narrow the range of strategies used in its conduct. But a further problem, and this is a problem, I guess, particularly to the ears of an international lawyer with the terminology of a war against terror, is if there really is a war being waged, all the armed forces and military facilities of the members of the coalition for winning Iraq, for example, including Australia, would become legitimate targets. So if we are at war, it would be perfectly legal in international law for any military installation in Australia to be attacked. And Vaughan Lowe, the titular professor of international law at Oxford, has pointed this out, that on the analysis that this is a war against terror, all al-Qaeda combatants could be killed on site or detained, but under the laws of war, they couldn't be punished for their participation in the conflict unless they committed war crimes. So it's hard to imagine that our politicians really imagine these consequences from the rather loose and dangerous vocabulary of war. The third problem, I think, in this age of terror, this war of terror, is that the fight against terror is presented with such national and international significance and urgency that it makes talk of human rights seem sometimes almost frivolous, irrelevant, irresponsible, or hopelessly idealistic. We see this very, very much in the political debate here in Australia, but also, I think, internationally, that people, for example, who are interested in human rights are often just derided. The term civil libertarians, I've noticed, has begun to be used more and more as a way of just putting down these sort of rather selfish, inward-looking people who are interested in human rights. Now, as Colin's already suggested, terrorism is a really complex phenomenon, And it seems to me it's crucial to understand that to be able to work effectively against it. But it's also very easily used, as he pointed out, in this really omnibus way, to mean any activities that we don't approve of, or the activities associated with particular cultures and religions. I'm very struck by something that Konagiti's Prime Minister said in the wake of the Bali bombings. He said, his response to it was, well, look, the West is facing a monolithic terrorist threat. Now, that sort of idea that terrorism is somehow monolithic is, I think, extraordinary. It's politically effective, but absolutely inaccurate. As the Oklahoma bombing or the blowing up of the Rainbow Warriors showed, terrorism is the tool of many disaffected groups, and terrorists fit no particular profile, and Connor's shown that very strongly in his remarks. It also seems to me that this idea that Tony Blair is so attached to, the monolithic terrorism, plays into really problematic stereotypes of Western virtue and Oriental menace, which I think themselves can exacerbate the likelihood of violence. So it seems to me that the failure to understand the complexity of terrorism and its causes can very readily lead to this judgment that human rights are a marginal, minor issue in the fight against it. So the new wave of security laws that we've seen across the world, and obviously particularly here in Australia recently, are justified by their drafters as essential for the preservation of our civilization. And there's very little attention being given to the darker side of their implementation. It's striking that in some countries, anti-terrorist laws and practices have targeted particular groups such as political activists, asylum seekers, refugees, religious and ethnic minorities. We've seen that to a certain extent in Australia. But I was struck by a report by the UN Special Representative on Human Rights Defenders, Hina Jilani, in 2002. And she showed very sort of strongly in that report how anti-terror laws have been used to target human rights groups in a lot of countries. For example, people fighting for Tibetan independence in China being labelled as terrorists by the Chinese government. And another interesting sort of development of this whole wave of terror laws is a phenomenon that's noted most particularly by criminologists. They use a curious term to me, transubstantiation, but this term has a lot of resonance for people brought up in Catholic schools like me. But it's also used by criminologists to mean the way that the very broad powers asserted against terrorist suspects are making their way into mainstream policing through indiscriminate application in regular criminal activity. But I just want to end with the proposition that it's really striking that really both sides in the human rights terrorism debate invoke the idea of a balance to explain their support or criticism of particular anti-terror laws. So the idea is that a law should strike a balance between the rights and freedoms that we associate with democracy on the one hand and with the hard-headed realisation that tough action is essential to respond to terrorism and to achieve security on the other. So the only conceptual difference sometimes between the debate is where the balance actually should be struck. But I want to suggest, and others have done this also, that the idea of balancing human rights and security concerns isn't a useful one at all, because of the implication that the protection of human rights and the prevention of terrorism are somehow inevitably at odds with one another. The notion or of a balance or a set of scales gives almost a sort of a quasi-scientific air to the discussion, but it doesn't explain what will be put into the balance or how the right balance will be judged, or who is best placed to judge it. And it seems to me, and I want to end with these words of Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General, he says, if we compromise on human rights in seeking to fight terrorism, we hand terrorists the victory they cannot achieve on their own.
Thank you very much, Hilary. Okay, now what I'd like to do tonight is present three sets of questions to both of our speakers. Firstly, looking at some of the challenges which terrorism poses to rights and freedoms. Secondly, looking more generally at Human Rights Acts and the role of Human Rights Acts in the war on terror. And thirdly, talking a little bit about some of the causes and solutions to terrorism from a legal perspective. So, Konagiti, if I can start with you. Human rights law seems to me only marginally useful in restraining excessive anti-terrorism laws and policies. It seems possible to deem a very wide range of invasive policies as compatible with rights. Some rights are vaguely worded and support contradictory viewpoints. Human rights law is shot through with exceptions, and judges usually defer to the executive government in their judgments about the extent of the threat and the proper responses to it. Governments have co-opted the language of rights to justify everything from torture to military intervention. Kanagiri, have rights lost their power in the face of terror?
Well, I don't think they've lost their power, but there is a downside to legalization of rights. The upsides are obvious. You get inculcated into the culture, you get the police and authorities to take rights seriously, etc. But of course you can't put rights into legislation as absolutes, because they're not. And one of the things you can demonstrate with students early on is they're not, and so on. And Bentham made a complete joke of the French Declaration of the Rights of Man, because he concentrated on the apparent absolutism of the claims. But once you concede that, and you have to concede it, let's face it, you then build in things like exceptions, to use the European parlance, which are necessary in a democratic society, are okay. And then you worry that maybe there's some overarching emergency. And then you say you can have derogations where you can actually depart from the rights where there's a public emergency. Now, these are the risks which, interestingly, in the 19th century, this guy from Oxford, Dicey, saw and said, show me a bill of rights and I'll show you a police state. So rights can be used to legitimise. And there is something, what you say there, where you are being held indefinitely and you're told this is compatible with your human rights. You're being beaten up and you're being told it's okay because we're not killing you. It's compatible with human rights. And that's what I was alluding to at the end, that our culture then has taken it that wages war on other people while claiming to be human rights abiding. But you can overstate the extent to which this has happened. In the past I've done so. I used to say the English judges are just colluding in the legitimisation of repression of Irish people and calling it all rights compatible and so on. But the British judges, to give one example and then stop on this one, they have actually quite strongly stood up just recently to assertions by government that attacks on liberty and freedom are human rights compatible. So House of Lords, a bunch of upper middle class men in the main, from backgrounds you would have thought are completely uncontroversial, have said, these derogations don't work. Sorry, you're not going to get away with it. And then, just the other week, as this judge, totally normal judge in the High Court, says this new house arrest type thing the British government persuaded Parliament to enact, he says it's so unjust, it beggars belief. He says, I cannot accept that this is fair. So it's not entirely a pessimistic story. And once you stick to what human rights involves, fair procedures, dignity, respect for political speech and so on, then it has a chance of fighting back if you've got elements in the state brave enough to stand up to governments asserting the needs of counterterrorism. And that's tricky to have. Not all cultures have that.
But what about this Belmarsh case a couple of years ago, where the House of Lords said, the indefinite detention of suspected terrorists who couldn't be deported is discriminatory. But most of the judges upheld the British government's view that Britain was facing a public emergency threatening the life of the nation. Only Lord Hoffmann really said, let's get real here. Public emergencies are where the whole life of the nation is threatened, not the isolated prospect of a suicide bomb, as appalling as that is. Certainly doesn't threaten the whole British nation. Do you think the British government hit the panic button too early by declaring a state of public emergency? And was the court too deferential to the executive's judgment about whether Britain was facing that emergency?
Well, supposing you have a properly functioning, broadly speaking, democratic society, broadly speaking, not a police state, and we say Britain falls into that category. I'm not one of these alarmist people who's going to tell you Britain's like Burma or anything, There is a really serious question about who should have the responsibility to judge that there's an emergency. And the British government's view, with which I have some sympathy, I have to say, is if there's a mass explosion, we're the guys who have to go out and explain it. We have access to data. Unless you really feel that we are coming to you with bad faith, that we are essentially lying, and I'm not one of those people who assumes that everybody lies in this way all the time, then there is something to be said for leaving with an accountable government, judgments about the existence of emergencies as being within their reach. Now, it's an entirely different matter, as the Lord said in that case you refer to, then to introduce a whole lot of disproportionate measures or irrational measures, measures that don't meet the alleged needs on the basis of this claim that there's an emergency. So the acceptance that there's an emergency, which in a democratic society, I think in the end of the day, has to be a judgment made by executive, is not giving the executive a blank check to engage in all sorts of wild behaviour on the basis of it. And the House of Lords proved that itself, where they then go on to say, notwithstanding the emergency, what you've done to introduce, to alleviate the alleged emergency is counterproductive, foolish, disproportionate, and has no rational purpose. That seems to me to be about right, actually. And therefore, Hoffman's wrong, actually. And had Lord Hoffman's view been that of the majority, that judgment would have been easily discounted, I have to say. Now, this is a crude political observation, not a legal one, by the politicals. Because they would have said, what they've said about Lord Hoffman, who is this guy to tell us what the position is? And they could have got away with it in a way. It was much harder for them to argue the case against the disproportionate nature of their response.
Now, Hilary Charlesworth, this a similar question confronts international law, the relevance of rights, the relevance of international law. Since the Iraq War, Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, there's been a sense that international law and the United Nations are in eclipse, that they've somehow lost their relevance in the face of hegemonic American power and the threat of terrorism. Many international laws are ambiguous. There are double standards in their application and selectivity in their application. Now, you're a career international lawyer with an interest in preserving your profession. How badly has international law been damaged in the war on terror, and in what ways?
Well, I think that a lot of law students feel the same anxiety about international law because they see domestic legal systems as regular and as easily enforced and as really apolitical and as somehow the perfect model. And then they come and they study international law, and sometimes they get very frustrated because they say, look, where's the international police force? There is none, and so on. And I often think the difference between the perhaps more political appearance of international law and the more legalistic sides of domestic law, I often think that difference is much exaggerated, because if you actually look at the way that our domestic laws are enforced, there is a heavily political element in them. There is inconsistency in the implementation. There is a lot of debate about the meaning of particular laws and so on. So I first of all want to say that what I've really always liked about international law is that it is highly political and it wears its politics on its face, if you like, whereas I think a lot of other legal subjects can obscure the political way that they've been devised. So I'm not too concerned about the discipline in that sense. I always think international law is in a sort of like a permanent state of crisis, because if you're as old as I am, has been teaching international law as long as I have, I can remember all the times when, for example, the invasion of Panama in the 1980s, when people sort of thought the invasion of Panama by the US, that this was an absolute flagrant violation of international law, which it was, and that this was spelling the end of international law. And there seems to be constantly the sense that we're just about to see the end of it, and yet it always somehow survives. But the other observation I'd make, particularly about the war against Iraq and Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and all the scandals that come out, in fact, they've almost had the opposite effect. I've been very struck by the fact that international law has almost had a renaissance, in the sense that there's been a lot more interest in the rules of international law. I think a lot of people who've had no previous interest in the area have really been trying to search for, well, what are the standards? How can we judge these issues? How can we say that what's happened at Abu Ghraib or what's going on at Guantanamo Bay is wrong? And I think it's really offered a language, a vocabulary, if you like, to explain some of our really deep-seated concerns about it. So I actually see, in a sense, the war against Iraq has prompted a real explosion of interest in international law.
Okay, well, a follow-up question based on that answer. You've previously in your writings criticised the obsession of international lawyers with spectacular crises like the invasion of Panama or the invasion of Iraq and so forth, which you argue obscures the development of an international law of what you call everyday life. And you go on to argue that poverty, malnutrition, poor sanitation, systematic discrimination against women, environmental destruction and so forth are not seen as attractive as war for international lawyers. Why do you think this is? And isn't thinking about these ways of stopping mass violence and terrorism a worthy obsession for international lawyers?
I first sort of make the response that in a way international lawyers are typically interested in only very particular forms of systemic violence or big time violence. So they're fascinated by, terrorism is obviously a growth industry in international law, they're fascinated by particular forms of military violence. But you can see, for example, a lot of large scale violence just goes accepted by international law, and you could just think of violence against women, which we're told is in epidemic proportions in all countries of the world by the each year the UN Development Reports, Human Development Report that comes out. So first of all, international law has a very limited focus on particular forms of violence. So I would say, first of all, it needs to expand its vision of what violence is. But more generally, what did I mean by an international law of everyday life? Really struck by the fact that if you look at the international law academia, or the type of books that emerge, there is so much focus on weapons and war, and there is very, very little attention on issues such as the incredible damage caused by HIV/AIDS or the massive inequality that has led to the vast amount of poverty. So international lawyers seem to be able to focus on immediate events, but they are much less interested in trying to turn their minds to, is it possible, and I leave that as a question, I think it's a really tough thing to do, but is it possible to try to develop legal strategies that could respond to the massive injustice of poverty or disease or so on? So I guess you would know this too, and kind of probably when you're listening, when students come to see you to write on honours topics or masters or PhDs, if I had a dollar for each time somebody wants to focus on the war against terror or humanitarian intervention, I would be a rich woman today. I think very few, I think it's something about perhaps the way we teach international law and perhaps the very limited way that we see the problems facing the world. We see security as simply military security rather than more broadly.
So I'm lucky I didn't approach you to do a PhD on terrorism.
Well, I would have been much nicer than you are.
Now, I mean, part of your argument about this sense of crisis in international law is based on exposing the language used by lawyers and in academic writing. Conor Geary, you've also written much about the language of terrorism, the war on terror, this so-called axis of evil and so on. What does the language of terrorism reveal to you about the distribution of global political power, and how does such language affect human rights?
I want to make a point about international law in a minute, but I'll deal with that directly. And I'll deal with it the following way. In Ben's question just earlier to Hillary, he says age of terror, or war on terror. Now, when I did a debate with Peter Goldsmith, who's the Attorney General in England, a couple of years ago, he went out of his way to say, I never used the term war on terror. And he meant it sort of superior way. And we all agreed. And then for a little while, it had inverted commas. But because Rumsfeld and Cheney and other people like that go on and on and on about it, and all their cohorts in the media do, we started doing it. And you see this thing, with respect, Ben, I'm not playing it, you know. Age of terrorism. What age of terrorism? In the early 90s. What age of terrorism? No, I mean, this isn't Ben. This is, I always say, an age of counter-terrorism. I went to see this guy. I was amazed by him. He looked like Robert Kennedy then. Bremer. People have forgotten this. He was the ambassador at large for counter-terrorism. He was appointed by Reagan or the older Bush, who we all thought was mad at the time. Now we can see he was absolutely civically minded and Bremer had behind him, he had a graph. Incidents of international terrorism. And it was going up and up and up and up. And then it went hysterically up in a different colour. And I couldn't believe this because I thought the whole place is very quiet. There was no incidents. So I asked him.
He said, no, what we did, he said, was it was going down and we reclassified. Now, you laugh. Listen to the age of terrorism on the State Department's own stats, the United States State Department, not the Libyan or the Cuban one. The 2005 country reports, there were 2003, there were 625 deaths from terrorism, the age of terror. But there were suddenly, in 2004, 1,907 deaths and 3,168 attacks. There were 6,700 injuries. So there's been an exponential increase. And then the small print, this is because they've redefined violence within Iraq as terrorist violence. So they're at the same game. We mustn't, and this is I'm answering indirectly the language of terrorism, we must not allow the premise to be accepted that there is this horrific level of violence generating large numbers of deaths which renders us people living in an age of terrorism. We're not living in an age of terrorism. It is only when there is very little political violence that we think we are, because we notice it. So what kind of deaths? This is to answer directly Ben's point. It's people like us. When people like us get killed, it's international terrorism. When other kinds of people die as a result of political violence, it isn't. So we think there's an age of terrorism when a few people like us are killed for political reasons. And we must, therefore, break free of the idea that the definition of terrorism depends on the ethnic or class identity of the victim. Because that's essentially what goes on here, in my view. The people who die who are not white first world people are the unfortunate victims of counter-terrorism. Usually they're bad guys. But when we die, it's always we're the victims of terrorism, and we need to address that. And I think it's a very serious point about how the language is fixed, and I alluded to this in my opening remarks, the language is fixed to identify our kind of violence with our tanks, with our armies, with our airplanes, with our ships as counter-terrorism. And their kind of violence, the hapless individuals who have nothing to fight against us with, but who therefore, because of their weakness, take hostages, kill easy targets and so on, as terrorism. You know, we know all about the Munich Olympics. How many people know how many hundreds of people were killed by the mortar attacks on Palestine that took place after the killings in Munich in 1972? Almost nobody. How many people know the number of deaths that follow so-called Palestinian terrorism, which are the result of bombardment on territories by Israeli forces? It doesn't count as terrorism. On international law, I agree with Hillary. I think, actually, this is a very important moment for international law. What's been fascinating in Britain is how Mr. Blair has been unable to escape the consequences of the universal view that this was an illegal war. Now, I remember a time when international law didn't really matter. It has mattered in that it is politically important to ordinary British people, not just a bunch of professors. It matters to them that he broke the law. At least, it's the commonly held view that he did. And Mr. Bush, like the Emperor Julian, who tested paganism after Constantine, to carry the Catholic theme of the evening, Mr. Bush has experimented with the attempted obliteration of international law. And where has it got him? So I would expect, being optimistic, that actually international law will not only survive, but will be renewed in its energy, because the world will have been reminded of its absolutely essential status in our culture.
But if I can just make a comment on that, one thing that's fascinated me as an observer of the UK is, I guess, Tony Blair's way of really riding roughshod over sort of classic rules of international law and the invasion, and yet being incredibly virtuous about them in the context of Guantanamo Bay. So we here in Australia look at what we see as pretty strong statements by the British Prime Minister, except very different to our own governments, where he seems to us quite bravely to have stood up and said to his allies, the Americans, look, Guantanamo Bay is appalling, we can't accept it, send our people back. And you'll be aware, of course, of David Hicks desperately trying to get British citizenship so he can bask in the umbrella of Tony Blair's love of international law. So my question for you is, Connor, what sort of explains, on the one hand, his absolute lack of interest in following the US, it seems, really blindly into this war, and yet on the other hand showing tremendous, I'll call it virtue, in inverted commas, in parading it in other contexts.
Well, Tommy Blair Premisher says, I rather fancy invading Iraq. I wonder, is it lawful? And then he asks, he rings up this fellow, Goldsmith, I've mentioned, and he says, you're the Attorney General, is it lawful? And the Attorney General hasn't a clue, he's a commercial barrister, and he's succeeding. He rings round, you lot, the international professors, and they all say, good heavens, no, good heavens, no, good heavens, no, and eventually he gets this fellow, whom I work with, who says, I think you should invade everywhere pretty well. And I think, therefore, you might as well invade there, but I've got another 58 countries we should invade too. And he says, good, you're a man, have you got time to do an opinion? And so it comes back, and then he gives a convoluted opinion, Goldsmith, to the Prime Minister, pages and pages of maybe this, maybe that, on the other hand, this, that, and the other. And then Blair is happy with that. But then the chap who runs the army says, before I start killing the foreigner, is it lawful? So the phone call comes through to Goldsmith. He has to give a yes or no. He gives a yes on the basis of the facts as he has been presented them by the client. So Blair, Mr. Blair, doesn't see the distinction that you've drawn, because from his perspective, it is a lawful war. And he has been able to point to an opinion, a piece of paper, which permits that to be believed to be the case. The problem with international law is we can't get an injunction to stop it. Normally what happens when you have rival barristers' opinion is you've got some person who's the referee, and you get various well-known remedies to stop it. There isn't a referee here, so he can hold to this position, one that many people who know far more about international law than me, and including, I think you hold this view, would regard as quite irrational. The claim that the war is lawful. He can hold it because there's no adjudicative forum that permits him to be wheeled out of court into an asylum.
You did say this would be recorded, didn't you, Ben?
You won't be allowed that in the
And in defense of my PowerPoint slide and the title. I think I should say that this was a ruthless marketing ploy, and people wouldn't have come if our title was, for example, Speaking of Rights and Liberties in an Age When Some Politicians Erroneously Describe Us as Living in a War on Terror. So,